Welcome to Inclusion Bites, your sanctuary for bold conversations that spark change. I'm Joanne Lockwood, your guide on this journey of exploration into the heart of inclusion, belonging, and societal transformation. Ever wondered what it truly takes to create a world where everyone not only belongs, but thrives? You're not alone. Join me as we uncover the unseen, challenge the status quo, and share stories that resonate deep within. Ready to dive in? Whether you're sipping your morning coffee or winding down after a long day, let's connect, reflect, and inspire action together. Don't forget, you can be part of the conversation too. Reach out to joe.lockwood@seechangehappen.co.uk to share your insights or to join me on the show. So adjust your earbuds and settle in. It's time to ignite the spark of inclusion with Inclusion Bites. And today is episode 188 with the title, The Art of Authentic Living. And I have the absolute honour and privilege to welcome Sam Turlington. Sam is a non-binary, award-winning actor and multi-hyphenated creative whose work champions queer joy and the complexity of authentic storytelling. And when I asked Sam to describe their superpower, they said that it is seeing people soulfully, honouring the truth of their experience. Sam, welcome to the show.
Hello, it's lovely to be here.
So judging by the accent, you're not based in the UK where I live. So where in the world are you?
So I'm American. I live in New York City, but I have really strong ties to the UK. I got my master's degree in Glasgow.
And I think you were saying before we went on air that you spent a lot of time working up in Glasgow and you've just come back to the US.
Yes, recently. I do. I'm actually working on a film in Glasgow at the moment, and a lot of my colleagues are in London as well. So I pop over and we create things together and yeah, I'm all over the place.
I'm fascinated by the term multi-hyphenated. So what is a multi-hyphenate creative?
So essentially, you know, when I first trained, I got my BFA many, many years ago. You could just kind of be one thing. Like you focus on one thing. And that for me at the time, that was just an actor. And as my career has developed and shifted and changed, and as I have developed and shifted and changed, I've taken on other positions. You know, I've produced films. I have directed plays. I don't know that just one title suits me. So, but saying 12 of them would be a mouthful. So just, I'm a creative arts multi-hyphenate. Boom, there it is. But always an actor first.
So it's kind of the identity equivalent of being non-binary, I guess. So you're not nailing yourself to any particular identity there.
Absolutely. I think my entire life could be summed up as if I find myself on a binary, I jump off of it immediately.
So what makes you tick? What was your kind of inspiration as a young person to plot your course in this direction?
So I have a fundamental curiosity at the core of my person to just connect and wonder. And I grew up in a not a small town, but in a small southern space where I didn't really have a lot of access to the wider world around me. And I found myself just gravitating towards anything that was different from what my upbringing had introduced me to. And that's how I fell into acting, because as an artist, as an actor, you get to take on other people, other personalities. You get to walk in another person's shoes. You get to research their experiences and put yourself in scenarios that you yourself would never find yourself in. So I think in a strange way, my core nature of curiosity and wanting connection with the outside world led me to acting. And then I'm pretty sure it's that led me even deeper in myself to discover that I'm non-binary and that my experience of the world is much more varied than I originally thought when I was a kid.
Just being an actor, playing a part through someone else's words, I guess, most of the time when you're acting, someone else has scripted you. Mm-hmm. You're someone else's persona. Did that give you an opportunity to maybe step outside of yourself and try on new things? Is that kind of what happened there?
Absolutely. I would say, you know, when, as a young actor, you get a script and your first instinct is to say, well, how would I do this? And then you learn very quickly, oh, that doesn't actually serve, you know, the play or the film or whatever it is you're doing. So I felt a freedom to be like, oh, great. I don't have to think about what Sam would do. I get to use the tools I have to figure out what this person would do. And then the freedom that comes from that to be like, great, I don't have to worry about how I feel about a thing. I know how they feel about a thing. And then the inevitable conclusion of that is, okay, well, I, Sam, do not understand why this kind of person would make this kind of decision because it's so vastly different from what I would do. So then you have to, you know, whatever kind of research you do, talking to people. I sought a psychology minor when I went into my time in university. I was like, I have to understand why people do the things that they do. And really all that was doing was fostering greater empathy for people in the world around me. So it's amazing how all that kind of plays in together.
Yeah. When I used to run IT companies, and when I tend to transition about 10 years ago, give or take, I embarked on this new part of my career, both well, career and identity. And I was looking for what I was going to do in the middle. And I thought I would try and get into acting because I had a few friends who did bit parts, you know, the sort of, mm-hmm. yeah, they were the person walking behind somebody or they were serving them at the table, you know, the sort of minor roles. And I registered with a load of agencies and I never got anywhere as it happened, but I did have a couple of auditions doing a few things and it kind of got me into that. It made me realize that I didn't want to do it, to be honest, but it was fascinating because I actually changed my bio to being aspiring actor at one point. You know,
I love it.
You have to manifest it for it to become real, don't you? So I tried to manifest it on my bio and I just decided it didn't pay very well, you know. It doesn't, you know, when you're in that early stage,
it really doesn't.
£100 for a day or something. And I thought, that's a lot of work to go all the way to London and back and stand around and maybe get to that. And I decided I wanted to focus on higher worth opportunity.
I absolutely understand. The amount of work that you have to put in as an actor compared to the benefit and the compensation that you get, especially early career, is near impossible sometimes. I'm inspired by, I don't know how younger me did it. I really don't. And I applaud them. And any young actor who's starting out right now, particularly, goodness gracious, they're my heroes. The leap of faith you have to take and the amount of work you have to put in and the amount of rejection you have to deal with in an already tumultuous world that's rejecting you and your identity potentially is overwhelming.
Yeah. But I soon figured out that my stage was different. It didn't need to be an acting stage. So I'm now a keynote speaker, a professional speaker on stage. Mm-hmm. So you still bring that larger than life persona. So you,
absolutely,
it's authentic, but it's a bigger version of you. It's not the quiet you, it's the stage you. So yeah, I enjoy performing because I think being a professional keynote speaker is a performance as well. It has to have act one, act two, act three, and a thank you at the end. So yeah, it is like being a solo performer, solo act.
For sure. The overlap between public speakers and keynote speakers and actors, the Venn diagram is a circle, basically. It's the same thing, except for I think you usually control what you're going to say. And we sometimes are saying other people's words.
Sometimes I don't know what I'm going to say next. So it is like ad lib sometimes. It is, yeah. Lots of and.
Improv.
And improv, yeah.
Yes, and.
Yeah. So, yeah. So, but I mean, obviously I know what the topic is when I stand on stage. I know what I'm going to talk about roughly. But in all seriousness, and if you're looking to book and pay me to do anything, don't worry. I always get it right. But I often don't know what I'm going to say next until it actually comes out of my mouth because it is conversational often.
Yes. I actually think that's a really wonderful skill. And it's something that all actors have to be in some way, shape, or form good at improv. And if not improv, when you're in a play, you have to be so comfortable with the script that it's as if you are saying it off the cuff. It's as if it's not pre-planned. So I think knowing the shape of a conversation, knowing the shape of what you want to say, knowing, okay, we're going to go here, we're going to move here, we're going to end here eventually. that's the most important thing. You don't always need to know exactly what words and exactly what order are coming out of your mouth, but knowing what the journey is going to be is incredibly important and a really good skill to have when you're working on a very wordy play, because your errors are going to happen. You're going to make mistakes, and recovering from that is really the mark of a true professional, how you recover.
And presumably it's not just you that messes up, it's the person you're acting against or with. And they've gone off on one and you're thinking, well, that's not in my script, but I'll just have to rock with this and see what happens. See when you come back and I'll pick it up from wherever you leave it.
Yeah, you just got to roll with the punches sometimes. And if it goes off the rails, it goes off the rails. And if you're in a play, it's going off the rails live in front of a bunch of people. And either they're going to be on board or they're not going to be on board. And it's your job to get them on board with whatever madness is happening.
I guess you've got to have faith in the writer, because everything you're saying should be optimized to be part of the story or a necessary plot. You're often not just saying words for the sake of it. They're part of evolving the character, aren't they?
They should be. Should be. I think I didn't know this when I was a young artist, but I have more experience now that you can hear the difference between a good script and just a script by how important is every word that the characters are saying. Is all the details coming out in an organic way? Is it a show me, don't tell me kind of thing? You can really hear if there's filler, if there's just fluff language, like the writer was like, oh, this might sound a bit clever if I say it like this, but it doesn't serve the purpose of the story. And they're out there. You're going to...
Yeah.
I've auditioned with some doozy scripts, but, you know, that's my job to make it better and make it real and solve the problem, as we say. You always want to solve the problem.
Do you find yourself having your own version of predictive text in your head where you're listening along to something and you know exactly what the next character is going to say? I mean, I watch TV and films all the time thinking, and I'm reading out the next time, and Marie's looking at me going, how did you know they were going to say that? It was just going to happen.
It is. All the time. Yeah, the same. Em and I will be on the couch and they'll be like, especially in high dramas, there's always those long pauses waiting for the next character to speak. And 9 times out of 10, I'm like, I know exactly what they're going to say.
And it's not even the gist of what they're going to say. It's actually the word, you know. Because there's lots of superlatives they could have picked. Mm-hmm. And I just say, duh, 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 duh.
There it is.
Exactly what they just said, almost in time with them as well.
Yeah.
Maybe I became invested in the character and I became with them.
Honestly, that might be you syncing up with the character and their narrative. That's a form of acting as well, is being able to empathetically get into the headspace of someone else so much that their words are coming out of your mouth. Absolutely.
So, you obviously hang out in creative space a lot, mm-hmm. as a thespian. If you identify as a thespian, a producer, or your hyphenates out there, I would imagine as someone who isn't in that space that it's a very open, queer friendly type environment. Is that a truism?
Say yes with an asterisk. It's the majority of creative spaces are going to be open to queer people and multiple identities and things like that. It shocked me to discover that some creative places are not. I never really considered that. I kind of took for granted that everyone who works in this industry has the level of empathy required to just be cool with everybody. And be specifically inclusive of everybody, because being cool with someone and being inclusive of them are very different things. And a few years ago, I went to a play that I didn't know anything about, but someone was like, hey, I have a ticket, let's go. It was a small off Broadway play. And I was not in the audience very long before I realized this is a conservative propaganda piece. And I am surrounded in a theater with actors, with directors, all of the normal people, but they're putting on this play that's saying some really not okay things. And it was my first interaction with, how could this happen in our community? I didn't know these spaces existed. And so, of course, I go out into the lobby afterwards, and there's some prominent conservative media figures there, and I'm like, this is odd. And I talk to, like, the house manager and stuff, and I'm like, how in the world... Do spaces like this happen? And she goes, well, we all have to eat and we have jobs to do and we get hired to do these jobs. And sometimes the people that we're working for are not great. But we don't control who rents the theater.
Some people are dicks and you can't legislate.
It was so shocking because, you know, the house manager was like, well, you know, I don't know when the theater gets rented, we don't know what show's going in there. So we're just as surprised as you. And I said, well, what about the actors? Do you know what's going on with that? And she was like, you know, it's an acting job. And some actors can just be like, well, you know, I'm not going to worry about it. I'm just going to do my job and then get on with it and take the paycheck. I was shaken by that news.
Can't bring your friends to the opening night, can you? That's...
Oh, I don't know.
Sort of the shame. I'm in this play. Or you can't come see it. It's awful.
Here's the thing. I've been in some bad plays, but I've never been in bad plays because they were written by bad people, like, or had something bad to say. I will happily invite my friends to a bad play that's not very good in the writing or the storytelling is green. But my goodness, I don't know if I could ever agree to be in a play that was actively trying to cause harm to somebody or is going to say something that could cause harm to somebody. So other than that very specific group of people that does exist, maybe 5% of the industry as I know it, most every creative space I'm in is wonderfully queer friendly. Thank goodness.
You said earlier about it's not you playing the role, you're having to step mm-hmm. into the character and the character plays the role, if you like. Mm-hmm. Where do you stand on your own identity? Do you play cis male, cis female characters as a non-binary person, or do you have to bring your identity into that role as well?
My first and foremost approach is to always bring my identity to a role, but I play cis women all the time. I've had a highlight for me has been playing cis men recently, which is really great. I usually, when I get cast as whatever gender identity, the first conversation I have with the director is, okay, you have chosen someone like me to play this role. Let's deal with the narrative dramaturgical ramifications of that, or the gift that that is. I was in a play last year by a wonderful playwright who's actually in the UK, and the role I was cast as was just called The Son, S-O-N. And it was a family dynamic where, you know, parents and then a son and a daughter, and they cast me as the son. And the director said, actually, how would you feel if we explore what this role's gender identity actually is? Does it actually need to be a cis man? It doesn't have to be. Let's see what happens. And we ended up coming to the conclusion that this character was non-binary, and it actually served the story better for them to be so. So that was a moment of me bringing who I am to the role, and it actually made the play better. And I think now the writer has actually rewritten the script to that character just is non-binary now.
I suppose at that point there, you're then having to give an authenticity consultation top to bottom on that script so that all the characters who interact with that character know that person's identity, how they're going to refer to them, how those relationships work, family, whatever. And all those little words that you get are gendered, suddenly you have to be reorientated, don't they?
Absolutely. One very specific example of that, I was in a production of As You Like It, and I was playing Touchstone, who's the clown in that play, and originally written for a cis man. But we decided that in the context of the play, this character would start out in stealth mode, hiding as if they were a cis man, but then transitioning to non-binary as the play went on. And we got curious of like, okay, how are we going to support that with Shakespeare's language in a very well-known play? And we ended up getting curious about neo-pronouns. And maybe Touchstone refers to themselves with zizemzir. And how does that fit with Shakespeare's language? And as we got curious, as we dove into the text and explored, we just decided, you know what? Shakespeare was doing all kinds of weird gender stuff a long time ago. I don't think he would mind. We changed all of Touchstone's pronouns in the script so that even when other characters referred to them, they used these neo-pronouns. And then there was an evolution of like when they were in the first act in the very strict, horrible court, they referred to Touchstone as him. And then they slowly started going to they, them, and then by the end of the play, Zemzir, which was so cool to figure out how that functions and to not put any limits on what it could be.
And it's actually quite like real life as well, because you don't go from here to there overnight. You don't wake up one morning and go, well, maybe you do, but you have to bring the world with you, don't you?
Yes. There's a joke that everyone makes. It's the he, him, to he, they, to they, she, to they, them, to she, her pipeline. It starts to go. And because it's an exploration.
It's a soft launch, isn't it? Coming out as non-binary, it can be a soft launch. But that 1,000%. Invalidates your, that also invalidates non-binary identities as seeing as you're just trying it out. That's actually my destination. So you've got to be careful. You're not propagating that myth, isn't you?
Yes, of course. Because some people can use non-binary identity as like a stopping ground to kind of sit and reorient before they move on to something else, because they might think that being non-binary is my destination, but then they get here where I am and they go, oh, I thought this was the conclusion, but it's actually not. And they can keep going. And then some people, like myself, get here and we go, sweet, we've made it home. This is the correct thing. And I have explored the other direction and been like, oh, nope, that wasn't right. So the freedom to move from one to the other and to validate everyone as they're passing through or making camp, as 'twere, I think is really important.
Yeah. No, I get that completely. Yeah. I skipped the middle bit. I just went straight to the other end. I knew I was going. Had the book, had the map, had
honestly,
the compass. Yeah.
Respect to know exactly where you're going, exactly what you want. All of my trans siblings who know exactly, like, this is me. I have such respect for that. And I have such admiration for it because I've just never been able to make up my mind.
But to be fair, my evolution was back in the 1970s. And, you know, think about how long ago that was. And she, her was bad enough in those days. You know, there was no queer option or gender queer or gender expansive options at the time. You had to be here or had to be here. And that bit in the middle was a destination rather than, as you say, a stopping ground. And
absolutely.
What's going on here then? Let's have a look around.
So true. I mean, as tumultuous as things are right now for our community, I can't fathom the experience that it was in the 80s, in the 70s, in the 60s and beyond. Yeah. Unbelievable.
Well, there was just... There was no language. There was nothing to envy or be worried about. It was, when you've got no options, you don't worry about having no options because you don't know there are options. So it's, you don't know what you don't know.
Absolutely. That was a big thing in conversations around my coming out. Because I, as far as the current generation believes, I came out later in life because so many of our community members get to come out when they're like children because they know exactly who they are and they have the access to the language. But non-binary did not exist when I was in high school, when I was in middle school. I don't think I met an out trans person until I was in college. So I had no access to that identity or that life or how it might apply to me, which hilariously, I figured that out through theater. I got cast not long out of school. I got cast in a play playing a trans woman. And that in that time, the conversation around casting cis actors as trans people was not existent, really, or was not loud like it is now. But I ended up playing a trans character, and it was the first time my brain went, is this me? This is the way I feel. And it was a doorway. I tell that I haven't ever told that director who cast me in that play. But I need to write her a letter and say thank you. Because if it wasn't for that play, I don't know that I would have gotten the unlock as early as I did in my adulthood. It would have been many, many more years later before figuring out who I was. Maybe she knew something that I didn't. I don't know.
So now you say that, I can relate to that experience where there's a life trigger that allows you to unlock that door, whatever that may be. So when I say I knew from a very early age in my life, there were certain triggers that if that hadn't have happened at that time, it may have happened later, but I can say that, well, that was a key to that door that went, now let's explore that. And then once you've got the key, you want to keep trying the doors, don't you? You want, yeah, I've got the key now. I want to keep opening stuff. So yeah, I see what you mean. You were in a situation where your brain went, okay, let's play with this and see what happens. Okay, actually, it fits. It works. Yeah.
Yeah. I remember so clearly, I was cast in this role and the director said, okay, so we've cast you as a trans person, and the writer of this play was a trans woman. And she has asked that you go to lunch with her so that she can help you understand the mindset, so that you can, doing my actor job, I am researching and getting information. So Carla and I went to lunch, and as she is orienting me to what it feels like, I just kept sitting there going, I know this. I know this feeling. This is also me too. Yes, well, of course. And then I start realizing, and I start asking her, wait a minute, do cis people not feel this way?
Apparently not. Apparently not.
Apparently not. I just remember at one point she kind of got quiet and she was looking at me and she goes, have you ever explored within yourself what you actually are, what you are? Like, what kind of exploration have you done in your life? And I said, well, I know I said at the time, I think I called myself bisexual, but pansexual was more accurate. And I was like, I've never really felt at home in the space that I was raised. I never felt at home in the gender assigned to this body by the space that I was raised in. But I've also never felt like the other called to me in a way. And she goes, all right, well, through this project, I just encourage you to keep asking questions. You're so curious about the world around you. I'd like you to be curious about yourself, because that's going to bring you home to this role. And she had no idea that what it was actually going to do is bring me home to me and myself and my authentic being. So honestly, if it wasn't for what I do for a living, I have no idea when I would have discovered my transness, when I would have discovered my non-binary nature. I don't know when that would have happened.
As you were talking, I was thinking about, this is how my brain works, blood types, and the fact that O negative is the universal donor and AB positive is the universal receiver. So do you feel that as a non-binary person, you're able to donate yourself into other blood types more readily than someone who is maybe rigid in their
absolutely
identity?
Absolutely. I feel so, now that I am fully my authentic self, I feel so connected to every experience. I don't feel like obviously I have my lived experience and other people have their lived experiences, and that will color what I'm able to relate to. But on a fundamental level, being able to identify with every person that I come into contact with and every story that I hear and being able to relate to it, especially when it comes to gender and sexuality and the internal struggles that we all experience. It's not like cis people don't experience struggle or don't experience, you know, the cognitive dissonance on the inside, or these are all universal feelings, just some of us express them outwardly in a very different way. So I would say, yes, I do.
Do you come across many cishet actors who attempt to play a queer character and either they don't get it or they're conflicted? I'm just thinking of Eddie Redmayne playing
The Danish Girl. Blank.
Yeah, Danish Girl, yeah.
Now, here in New York City, I can't think of any. I can think of cishet actors who have played cis, gay, or lesbian roles. And sometimes you see them in plays and you go, that's not how we talk, or that's not how we hold ourselves. So you can kind of see the seams a little bit.
The stereotype kicks in.
Yeah. Because, I mean, as an actor, stereotype is a little important because it gives you a quick flash look at something, but then you have to get curious and go past the stereotype and able to actually be. Because, you know, every stereotype is grounded in some kind of reality because that's how we categorize humans. So, but we need to unpack that and find out, you know, okay, is this a harmful stereotype? Is this a joyful stereotype? What kind of stereotype is this, and how can we actually get to the reality? And a lot of, in my observation, a lot of cis het actors, particularly cis men who take on gay male roles. They go to a stereotype that is common for their viewpoint, but not ours. Our community knows how cis gay men are. The straight community doesn't always know that. So, but I think it's a little more, people are a little more mindful of that now. And there's so many actors who are out and proud. Just cast people for the roles that they need to be playing, you know? It's the same thing with, I'm a fat-bodied actor. Don't cast thin people to play fat people. Just don't do it. We know us. Let us play us.
Yeah, unless you've had boob sweat or got out of breath walking up down the stairs. If you're too fit, you're never going to appreciate the nuances and the, give me five at the top of the stairs.
Or something as simple as sitting in a chair. Because I'm larger bodied, I have the knowledge that most chairs are not structured for my weight. And so I'm going to tell you what, every time I sit, I'm just going to go down really slow to make sure this is going to be okay. And I am in the fat community considered a small fat. Okay. So if I'm worried about this, my other bodied friends, my fatter bodied friends are, it's a nightmare. It's a nightmare that the world is literally not built with them in mind. So you know what? We understand this. We understand what it is to like struggle to find clothes in your size and have to shop online because they never have your size in store, right? Or have to be perfectly put together all the time because of the stereotypes people associate with being fat. So, you know, it's just let people play their identities is what I think.
Yeah, I mean, I can identify as a past large body person. I was probably 300 pound plus at my max. 20, 22, 23 stone, and I've lost 140 pound, 120 pound recently. So yeah, I've been to that thing where we go to a pub garden in the UK and they've got that white plastic furniture. And it used to be a party trick. People would look at me and go, you really going to sit on there? Go, oh yeah. And I go, I'll be careful. And all of a sudden hear this cracking noise and suddenly you're on the floor and this thing has just gone like a baby giraffe up from underneath.
Right. It's just ridiculous. Literally, those plastic chairs. If I see those, I'm like, no. I'll be standing. Thank you very much.
And how uncomfortable is it? Everyone sits on the grass. You think, how do I get down there? How do I get back up? And it's bloody uncomfortable as a large body person just laying on the grass or sitting on the grass.
Yeah, it can be so ridiculous. And, you know, I'm really grateful that I'm a really active person and like my body because, you know, of what I do. And I've always been bigger bodied and I love the way my body moves and I love what my body can handle and the amount of stuff that it can do. But the fact that I have to make accommodation in my just like day-to-day life to fit into the world around me, like here in New York City, in every restaurant, tables are like yay far apart, like a couple inches apart. And they expect you to walk past those tables and to be sat. And I'm like, first of all of this lusciousness is not making it through that narrow little alleyway that you've made. But I don't think anybody should be forced into those narrow of spaces. It's just wrong. It's not okay.
Well, the diners on one side are going to get your butt in their face or wiping across their food. And the other side, it's probably your boobs, isn't it?
And then to my ultimate fear is that one day I'm going to try to squeeze through a space of tables like that. And they're going to have like a bottle of wine sitting on the table. And I'm just going to knock it. I'm going to knock that with my booty and then be like, I'm so sorry. Now I have to buy your dinner. And I'm just going to like throw myself in the Hudson. It's shameful. I can't. So, so bad. But if people would just be mindful and like move the tables a little farther apart, it's all you got to do. And then it would be fine.
See, as a reformed large body person, I've got these stories. I live with being larger than life for 30, 40 years of my life. I've had the problem with the tray table. You know, you're on the plane, you end up having to force it in and you end up with a bit above and a bit below the tray table and they put the dinner down there and it's sort of like wedged or you want the extra long seat belt, you know, the booster on a train.
Yeah. Air travel these days is just, it's just offensive to everybody. Airplanes are getting so uncomfortable because they're not thinking of anybody's comfort at all. And so I feel like a lot of the things that larger bodied folk have been saying, hey, maybe consider X, Y, and Z about how to fix this. Now, more straight-sized people are going, you know, yeah, it is uncomfortable. We really should have better things. Yeah. And to that, I say, you're welcome. You're welcome, straight-sized people.
But the airline industry is solving that problem by charging you to pick your seat or to get the aisle, to get the extra legroom, aren't they? So they're cashing in on people's size.
Yeah.
As a sales process, aren't they? That's what it is.
Yeah. I get offered upsells to first class all the time because they're roomier seats. They have more distance to the tray tables and stuff. And I'm like, oh, well, if you want to be more comfortable, go first class. I'm like, who in the world can afford this all the time? Like, it's ridiculous. No, absolutely not. I don't want to have to pay more just because my body exists the way it does.
Yeah. I remember I used to do a lot of short haul in Europe back in the 90s, and I was quite a big person. I remember more often than not, I'd have a window and you're praying for no one to sit in the middle. And then you take off and the person on the other end, and you look at each other and go, you dodged a bullet there. So, but sometimes I end up, you know, packed plane, I'd end up in the middle seat myself sometimes. And I remember walking up to my aisle, seeing the person by the window, and I look at them and go, yep, big person.
That's it.
Yep. My seat. And they look at me and go, oh, we get to sit. Oh my God. And then you end up sitting there eating your meal with your arms crossed and trying to sort of keep your elbows in it. And it's such an uncomfortable thing.
You know where I have had that experience recently? Here in New York, some of the Broadway houses are so small. Their seats, I don't know how anybody is comfortable in them. Like, I'm about a size 18, 20 American. I think that's, what, like a 22 in the UK?
Yeah,
and
yeah.
I was at the Nederlander Theater recently, and I sat in the seat. And I was with my mate, Bryce, and I was like, hey, buddy, I'm just going to have to snuggle up next to you because this poor woman next to me, I was like crossing my arms over, like pulling in as tight as possible. And Bryce, who's like a real fit guy, was like, yeah, my biceps are just, we're all sitting here tight together. And I really loved this perspective of like, you know, really swole dudes are like talking to fat people, being like, oh, yeah, us too. We're all having a hard time squeezing in here. It was hilarious, but too small. Like, I don't know why in the world they would want people to watch a play squeezed into seats like that. I barely remember anything about the first 10 minutes because I was so uncomfortable.
I also realized that you don't realize when you're a large body person that there's quite a lot of you on your butt and your back. So it actually pushes you further forward in the seat as well. So you actually the length of your knees is quite long. So when you lose weight, you realize that actually your bum goes further back in the seat and you've got a gap at the front of the seat now. But for years, I was thinking, how can anyone, I can't get my knees in here. And I remember sitting in the aisle, put my feet out, and yeah, it's so uncomfortable. They're just not designed.
It's so wild. And they cram you, and tall people as well. I have a couple friends who are very tall, and when we go to see shows, it's like they're constantly tucking their knees in and stuff. They're not made, most places are not made for dimensions outside of, I don't know, the standard body for the thieves, you know, like from the 90s or something. It's ridiculous.
Yeah. We're eating too much steak and red meat now. We're growing too big, aren't we?
It must be. I tell you, I haven't had red meat in a very long time. I'm a flexitarian. I mostly eat fish and chicken. And I didn't realize just how much red meat is in all of, like, especially as an American, and how much red meat is like the centerpiece of all of our diet in America. Like, it's all we eat. And sometimes finding meals, especially when I go to benefits and stuff, finding meals that are not beef or pork, it's really, really difficult.
My perception is that meat, you know, beef and pork, is cheap in the States compared with other parts.
It is.
And I don't want to get into a debate about your food hygiene and GM and all that kind of, but you've got a lot more cattle and it's a lot more, there's a bigger market. So beef steaks in the US are large and cheap, aren't they, generally?
Yeah. And varying in quality, of course. A big reason why I stopped eating particularly beef, but red meat, was because I just can't with how we treat our food here in the States. Growing up in a Southern home, I think we ate beefsteak 3-4 nights a week. It's just a normal thing to do, like a meatloaf with ground beef in it, or, you know, spaghetti and meatballs, like chicken fried steak, you know, just constant meat. So when I was vegetarian, it was a big deal.
I remember when I went to Florida with the family back in 2004, so 21 years ago, it was either steak or it was lobster and spider crab everywhere. We just or chowder.
We love our spider. We love our spider crabs. We love our crab legs buffet.
Yeah, it was. It was an all you can eat Red Lobster or something, whatever the brand is. Yeah.
I'm gonna tell you, Red Lobster's not an establishment that I visit anymore, but their cheddar biscuits. Come on now, they're pretty good. That's the classic.
Maybe next time I go. Next time I feel safe to come to the States, I will. And that kind of segues us onto another part of the conversation, really, is how are you and your buddies, for want of a better way of describing it, how is it? What's the world like from your perspective?
I mean, it's difficult to know the temperature of the water when you're sitting in it. That can be a struggle. I am incredibly grateful that I have spent years outside of the States because my time in Scotland allowed me to take a minute and reorient myself and look at my country from afar and really take stock of how things are. So, you know, of course, and it, being a performer, you know, anytime someone's like, how are things? My gut reaction is to always be like, oh, yeah, it's great. We're getting on. Everything's fine. But in all honesty, trans and non-binary folk, all queer folk in America are in crisis right now. You know, we are dealing with, much like our siblings in the UK, our government constantly putting laws on our bodies and trying to limit our movement. And even if the legalities and the logistics are not permanent fixtures, the conversations around them, the constant checking in, the constant hearing our identities weaponized is exhausting and, you know, draining. And it makes our joy and it makes our celebrations even more vital and rebellious. And I have never so fervently embraced joy as an act of resistance as I have right now. I didn't really know what that term meant until standing in this current cultural moment. Now I get what joy as resistance means because I have to live it every day. So.
Yeah, I often say to people that I'm a protest just by existing. You know, it's kind of, I make people uncomfortable just by the fact I'm here. If you've never been in that position, you don't know what that means. You know, just by standing somewhere and being present, you are polarizing people, aren't you?
Yeah. Me being visible is me saying something. Walking around as myself during the day, I am making a statement. I am a walking protest all on my own without meaning to be. I saw a TikTok recently that has just been echoing in my mind. You know how sometimes people go, oh, I don't get into politics. I don't like to get into politics. I don't follow politics. A woman on TikTok goes, well, politics followed you all the way to your house. Politics is very interested in you and is with you all the time. And that is the core of how I feel at the moment.
Quite stressful, isn't it?
Yeah. Thank goodness I have a good therapist. You know, it's exhausting. I will say, there is something magical that happens when your entire community is stressed out and exhausted and you all come together and you go, okay, we're going to be stressed out and exhausted together. And that creates tighter bonds. And I've never felt closer to my community than I feel now. But it is such a heavy weight. And I'm ready for it to lift. Something's got to give. And I don't know what that is.
And without sounding overdramatic, it does bond the community. I mean, you think about what's going on in Ukraine and how that's bonded the Ukrainian people together, what's going on in other war-torn territories, and what's going on in Gaza, probably.
Yes.
People are finding that solace in human contact in themselves. And I think the key thing from a human perspective is it's not having hope and not being alone, isn't it? Yes. And lonely. It's trying to find that kindred spirit. We need a tribe, don't we? We need a tribe.
Yeah.
And bonding together in times of need is what we do as humans. I think that's what's happening.
Yeah. A core tenet of our humanity is being together and getting through things together. No great achievement was ever actually achieved solo, alone. There is no world-changing thing that has happened with one person. there's always, if one person is put to the forefront of, oh, this stuff happened because of this one person, there were hundreds probably of people around them supporting them in some way, encouraging them in some way. So I think the power of community and the power of people is what's going to get us through all of this. I think it is the, particularly the queer community, the magic thing about all of us is that our resilience does something to the people around us. Seeing queer people be resilient inspires community and relation and empathy in other people. I have seen families who, you know, did not agree politically, but who had queer members in them. I have seen the more conservative of these family members pivot and go, you know what? I'm watching you rally with your people. I'm watching you rally with your community and standing on what you know to be true and your identities. And while we might not agree with you, you're right to do it and you're right to fight the good fight. And it's inspiring. And they have joined up and still not understood fully, but known it was right to do anyway. And I think that's an amazing thing about our community.
Is New York a relatively safe place? I mean, East Coast, West Coast, is it? In the middle that's the worst?
I find it to be a really safe place. I've lived here for over 10 years. And currently right now, we're in a time where a bunch of influencers online are like, oh my God, New York is so scary. New York is what it's always been. I feel very protected here. That's not to say that harm doesn't happen here and that there aren't people who, it's a very touristy place. People come from all over the world. So, you know, things happen here, but all in all, I feel safer here than I do pretty much anywhere else in the United States. I can tell when I leave New York City, there's a different feeling. But here, yeah, we're fine for the most part.
New York has zones anyway, doesn't it? It has the Bronx and places like that where you have to know where your community is and where your community isn't.
I know better than to go to Staten Island. I know better. I don't go there. Yeah. There's most of the communities keep to their own. No shade to Staten Island. I'm sure there's some really lovely people who live there, but, you know, that's not a...
I went to Staten Island once. When I was in New York, we heard that the Staten Island ferry was free.
Mm-hmm.
So we thought, well, if it's free, we'll go for a boat ride and go to Staten Island. So we went over
there. That's great.
Boat ride, loads of people, got off the other end, got on the next boat, came back again. So it's like we had a little free tour across the bay. It's great.
That's a wonderful way to see Staten Island and then immediately go back to Manhattan. And we do
see it from the boat and wave at it. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, I feel very privileged to live. I'm in Brooklyn specifically, and I feel very privileged to live where I do and to feel as safe as I do. I know there are people who come to New York or people who are here who don't have that same experience, and I definitely hold space for that. But compared to like where I grew up and what my experience would be if I was living where I grew up or, you know, some other place like all of our siblings in Texas or Tennessee, those places which are like actively dangerous for queer people. So in comparison, it's hard to ever say that I have a hard time here.
I was in Oakland last year in California and hanging around the Bay Area, San Francisco as well, on my own largely, apart from being at a conference, and I felt very safe. In fact, in Oakland, I felt less safe as a white person than it had nothing to do with my gender or what.
Interesting, yeah.
In fact, I was trans. I just felt nervous being around, they call them panhandlers, people begging on the street and tube and subways. I felt more wary about the potential drug culture on the street and that kind of thing. I felt more under threat by the random stranger somewhere than I ever felt around who I was, if you like.
Isn't that interesting that depending on where you go changes what otherness you have that is being called attention to. I'm in some spaces where, you know, my otherness of size calls attention to me. I'm in spaces where my otherness of gender calls attention to me. And, you know, sometimes I'm in spaces where, you know, my race is an otherness because I'm in a minority there. And it's just, it always is fascinating what you expect to be the thing that goes, I'm the only insert thing here in this space. And what makes you wary, how that shifts and changes as you move through the world.
Picking up on that, what you just said there, you know, you're the only one in that space. It's it's quite a lonely place sometimes, isn't it? Because you have all this responsibility to be the best one you can be, to not let your kind down, for whatever way of putting it.
Yeah.
But also hyper-aware that of that difference that other people perceive you and they clock you and suddenly you're on show, aren't you?
Yeah. Connecting it back to as an artist, I can't tell you how many times I walk into an audition room and I am the largest body in that space. I am also the queerest looking person in that space, visibly, clockably queer. And every time, you know, especially in film and television, all eyes will just turn and look at me. And I am very hyper aware of all the attention that is on me. And I'm like, all right, everything I do has to be perfect. Otherwise, people might make assumptions about other people who look like me. And it's a large responsibility to bear.
So you've got your queer responsibility, you've got your large body responsibility, you've got your non-binary, everything's going on. And your pansexuality's got to kick in there as well. And just, by the way,
multi-hyphenate. My multi-hyphenate identity constantly on display, and constantly I'm trying so hard to be a good advocate for my communities. Because, you know, as an extrovert, I feel like we have extra, you know, because we're the ones who will talk and engage with and have the capacity for it. I feel like I definitely have to take on that role as much as possible.
I just need a rest. I can't have a rest. I'm an extrovert. I've got to entertain everybody.
I'm on all the time, constantly on. Although the older I get, the more important I'm realizing taking the time to turn off and like just rest and be away from things. Really important.
A bit of neurodiversity kicks in, you get distracted on something, and then you get engrossed in something else.
All the time.
Sounds normal to me.
Yeah. It's just my life, you know? That's just, I'm, you know, neurodiverse. And so the way my brain works, I've learned to just roll with the punches and let my personality like embody that and follow that and sit and wonder, wow, how do people who don't have this experience just do? That's amazing. And be in awe of other people's experiences.
Yeah, for the people who've never opened that door, whatever that door is. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. You have the opportunity before you die to open the door and figure out.
Yes. It's never too late to open the door. It's never too late to crack the egg, as they say. And I encourage all people to do so.
Shut it again. If it's scary, just shut the door. Doesn't matter. Lock it. Throw the key away.
Yeah.
But only do it after you've tried it.
Yeah, life is too short not to open the door and at least see what's going on back there, you know.
It's a lot of fun, actually. Most doors are crazy.
Truly. I had no idea that my life would be this joyful and this wonderful on the other side of the door. I thought it was going to be scary and constant turmoil. But as bad as things are for our community, I've never felt so at home in myself and so joyful in the way that I live. I had no idea. So I will take the bad with the good easily.
What a conversation we've had. So we've been nattering away now for an hour and a half. Half an hour in, I said to you, we better press record. I wasn't going to waste all this. For anyone listening right now, we've been doing this half an hour before you started. We carried on and we could carry on for another half an hour, I'm sure, but it's been absolutely fascinating to meet you, Sam.
Likewise. We
both opened the door and we both bumped into each other and gone, wow, what a place. How can people get a hold of you? How can you help people?
So anyone who wants to get a hold of me, I'm on Instagram at S.E. Turley, and you can check out my website, www.seturlington.com, and shoot me a message. My contact information is all on my website, so I'd be happy to connect with anybody.
So anybody who wants to talk about, open doors, I guess.
Absolutely. You want to know about opening doors? Holler at me. I'll talk to you about, you know, picking the locks, how to relock the door if you need to. I'll help you over across the threshold. Absolutely.
Or just blatantly open it without any shame at all. And
joyfully walk in to kick the door down. I'm here. I'm queer. My back pain is moderate to severe.
It's been a blast. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
As we bring this conversation to a close, I want to express my deepest gratitude to you, our listener, for lending your ear and heart to the cause of inclusion. If today's discussion struck a chord, consider subscribing to Inclusion Bites and become part of our ever-growing community, driving real change. Share this journey with friends, family, and colleagues. Let's amplify the voices that matter. Got thoughts, stories, or a vision to share? I'm all ears. Reach out to joe.lockwood@seachangehappen.co.uk and let's make your voice heard. Until next time, this is Joanne Lockwood, signing off with a promise to return with more enriching narratives that challenge, inspire, and unite us all. Here's to fostering a more inclusive world, one episode at a time. Catch you on the next bite.